Now we're going to move on from there in a related manner. Our next speaker, Zach Roberts, was educated in Japan and he's had work experience spanning multiple geographies and both sides of the balance sheet. Now that's helped develop his passion for thinking differently. Zach now works, much to Mike's delight, as a fund manager, where he helps institutional investors explore complementary ways of achieving their investment objectives. Please welcome Zach Roberts.
Okay, thanks, Martin. As Martin mentioned, my career started as a financial services consultant, so mainly on the liability side. I then moved to in the global markets of an investment bank and more recently to a fund manager. So gradually I've moved closer and closer to assets. And one thing I discovered was that there's a lot more to assets than just assumptions for our actuarial models. And I actually think that a greater knowledge of assets, investments, financial markets in general can be very useful to actuaries looking to work in wider fields or even just wider roles with traditional actuarial employers. Some of the things that I think make actuaries suitable for wider roles are that, one, we're generally a pretty intelligent bunch. Two, our training makes us quite good at thinking through complicated or new issues in a logical, rigorous manner. And three, we have an understanding of statistics that's good enough to know that statistics are like a lamppost to a drunk man. Good for leaning on, but not very illuminating. So in that way, we know that it's best to ignore most statistics and instead focus on the drivers or causes of events. I also think actuaries are quite good at questioning new or unusual things, but I think we can actually go a step further, and my motto would actually be to question everything. So what I thought I'd do today, given I don't have the wealth of experience Mike has to talk through, what I thought I'd do is apply a questioning, first principles, logical approach to superannuation and see what we might come up with. Okay, so sticking with the theme of how far can actuaries go, let's put our thinking caps on for the next few minutes and question the way $1.4 trillion is managed. What I have here is the three main investment options for a typical superannuation fund. Now, normally with investing, if you're investing to achieve a given target, as these are, return target, it makes sense to try to do that with the least risk possible. And as we can see up here, as the return target decreases as we move across to the right, the risk does decrease. So far, so good. Now let's narrow in on one of these funds, the defensive fund, and ask some deeper questions. We have here a target of CPI plus 2%. Now, most of you in this room probably know that a 10-year inflation-linked government bond in Australia pays a return of CPI plus 2.5%, or actually more than that. So what we actually have here is a fund whose target is to underperform government bonds. Yet, as you can see, equities, property, credit, infrastructure, there's 80% invested in risky assets. So a first question that our actuary moving to wider fields might ask is, how does an investment team, a board of directors, and most probably an asset consultancy, sign off on such a risky asset mix for such a conservative investment target? Moving on. Let's now question the whole concept of diversifying across asset classes. It's often said that during the GFC, many asset classes became correlated and didn't behave the way they were supposed to. So maybe we could place less importance on asset class labels and instead focus on understanding investments and understanding what drives their returns. When looking at investments, ask ourselves things like, what drives the return behind this investment? What is the risk I'm taking that gives rise to an expected excess return? Under what conditions is this investment expected to do well? And also importantly, probably most importantly, under what conditions is it expected not to do well? So let's ask that question of our defensive fund here, starting with equities. Well, I'd say that really it's either poor economic growth or expectations of poor economic growth that would cause that asset class to expect to do poorly. Let's move to property. What do you know? Poor economic growth, expectations of poor economic growth are probably the key driver behind property doing poorly. Let's now move to infrastructure, credit. I'd say it's the same thing. So what we have here is, even though we've diversified across asset classes, we've got 80% of the portfolio exposed to the one return driver, that is economic growth. So the question that our actuary going into wider fields might ask here is, can we really expect to achieve real diversification when it matters the most, which is normally when economic growth is uncertain, if we diversify across asset classes that are all driven by economic growth? Let's go to the other 20%, the bonds. Okay, when it comes to diversification, they generally do the heavy lifting, because when markets are falling, generally interest rates are falling, so bond prices are going up. And by bonds here, we're talking government bonds, so we're not worried about credit. Maybe not worried about credit. So the question here really is, in today's market environments, do bonds have the diversification power that they have had in the past, and also, therefore, that we assume they have in our asset models? Now, unfortunately, there's two reasons that come to my mind as to why maybe they don't. One, interest rates are just lower now. And if interest rates are lower, they can't fall as far, so therefore bond prices can't go up as much. Now, we've all heard about a lot of developed countries around the world with their zero interest rate policies, but even in Australia, pre-GFC, you had a five-year government bond rate north of 8%. In the GFC, it fell to 4%. It's gone up again, but it's still less than 6%. So bonds simply just can't go up as much. The other one is that sovereign default risk. What if the next crash is actually driven by increasing fears around sovereign default? What we might actually see then is that government bond rates actually increase as investors price in a greater credit margin, a greater margin for risk in their prices. Let's take Portugal as an example. In March last year, the Portuguese government issued $1.25 trillion of a five-year bond at a yield of 3.5%. Last week, it was trading at 7.3%. So in just over a year, the price of that bond had fallen by 14%. So I wonder what Portuguese pension funds would say if you asked them about the diversification power of government bonds. So, finally, let's ask the question, could we actually come up with a different investment approach? Well, I've had a stab at it. Step one, choose your desired exposure to economic growth. Step two, get that desired exposure. And get it by investing in whatever investment, who cares what asset class it comes from, offers the best expected returns per unit of risk. And guess what? That's going to change over time. Step three, diversify by gaining exposure to investments that are driven by things other than economic growth, especially investments that are expected to do better, or at least not worse, if economic growth becomes uncertain. Step four, I'd say consider protecting against tail risk. Okay. One thing our actuarial training has probably taught everyone here is that it doesn't matter what asset model you're using, it's wrong. And in the tails, it's more wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Good demonstration of thinking differently and the power of asking good questions.